Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Barry Coburn, appearing here on behalf of the appellant. With the court's permission, I request to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. I should advise the panel just before we commence that there was some communication with the clerk's office last week, given that this is a sealed case, as to whether or not the courtroom needed to be sealed. And the parties have agreed, subject to the court's approval, that sealing the courtroom is not necessary so long as we would refer to the doctor or the appellant as opposed to using anyone's name.
My colleagues and I have discussed that matter, and we are comfortable with that proceeding. And we'll probably forget his name anyway.
Thank you so much, Your Honor. It is our submission to this court that the judgment of the district court denying a motion to quash the subpoena has to be reversed for at least two reasons. One reason relates to the language of the subpoena at issue, and the other is a more fundamental issue of active production, Fifth Amendment privilege jurisprudence. Turning to the first issue first, the language of the subpoena itself. The subpoena, which of course is attached as part of the appendix in this case, requires the physician, or rather the physician's attorney, to provide forthwith all original documents relating to the following patients, and then there's a list of patients. Then there is some language stating a copy of these documents is attached to the subpoena, the age or identification of the records being sought by the forthwith subpoena. But the language of the subpoena does not in any way, shape, or form limit its ambit just to the copies of the documents that are appended to the subpoena. The language is actually, A, it's much broader because there is no reason to believe that the documents that the government attached to the subpoena are, in fact, the sum total, the universe of all responsive documents. And moreover, the subpoena by its very terms requires the recipient of the subpoena to authenticate the fact that the other documents, if any, that would be responsive to the subpoena, plus what the government refers to as the originals of the documents that are the copies of which are attached to the subpoena, are in fact authentic. Now, with respect to the first issue, the issue relating to the language, it's our submission that this case falls fairly squarely within the doctrine that this court set forth in the Pons case. And the language in the Pons case was to the effect that the subpoena called for an act of production in its testimonial character fell somewhere between the response to a fishing expedition that was what was at issue in the Hubble case and the production of documents whose existence was, quote, a foregone conclusion, which was at issue in the Fisher case. Since there is no reason to believe, there's no basis, no factual basis at all that I'm aware of, to conclude that the copies that are attached to the subpoena are, in fact, the sum total of all the documents that are called for by the subpoena, then just as a fundamental matter of logic, just as in the Pons case, whereas some documents would have been known, that is to say the documents that are attached are known to the government. The other documents, if any, we'd submit there's plenty of reason to believe there may well be.
Says these documents. The subpoena says these documents, right?
Yeah. Well, it says...
it doesn't say examples of documents or those attached. It says these documents, copies of these documents.
I would have to say then, Judge Randolph, first of all, that's quite right. It does say a copy of these documents is attached to the subpoena, but the earlier language in the subpoena says provide forthwith all original documents relating to the following patients. So I guess the subpoena...
You know, it seems to me that your argument, maybe I misunderstand your argument, but the subpoena is directed to the attorney, right? The production by the attorney... There's no Fifth Amendment privilege that the attorney has to refuse to produce the documents.
Well, if I understand correctly,
let's clear that away, right?
That the attorney, qua the attorney in his own name
the
has?
The attorney in his own name.
Correct.
Right. Also, if the attorney produces the documents, the client of the attorney, right, the doctor, has his Fifth Amendment privilege is not violated either.
I don't agree with that.
Well, you don't agree with it, but the Supreme Court does in the Couch case and in the Fisher case. In both instances, the Supreme Court said there's no Fifth Amendment problem with the production by the custodian, and Couch, it was an accountant, and Fisher, it was an attorney. The question, and this is where I think your brief misses it, the question is whether, when it's the attorney, unlike Couch, as in Fisher, the question is whether it would violate the attorney-client privilege for the attorney to produce the document. And that turns on the question whether those documents were given to the attorney, put in custody, for the purpose of his rendering legal advice. And that's an issue that your brief doesn't address. And well, that's what the whole case turns on.
As I stand here, I'm just, sort of struggling to remember precisely what the language is in Fisher that addresses this issue. I mean, my general understanding, and I hope Your Honor will forgive me if I'm wrong, my general understanding is that what the attorney is asserting, just as in Fisher, when the attorney resists a subpoena like this, is essentially asserting the Fifth Amendment privilege on behalf of the client. I thought there was language in Fisher that explicitly indicated that an attorney had the right to do that. Now, with respect to the attorney-client privilege, the reason our brief doesn't—
Here's the language from Fisher. Documents transferred from the accused to his attorney are, quote, obtainable without personal compulsion on the accused. And hence, the accused, quote, Fifth Amendment privilege is not violated by enforcement of the subpoena directed toward his attorneys. This is true whether or not the Fifth Amendment would have barred a subpoena directing the accused to produce the documents while they were in his hands. That's at pages 398 and 397 of Fisher, and it's also page 328 of Couch.
Well, I do recall that specifically this issue is specifically addressed by the district court in its opinion. And if I remember correctly, the district court assumes without deciding, and I think this is in a footnote, that the documents would have been transmitted by the doctor to the former attorney for purposes of legal advice. So I think that issue basically is not one on which we're seeking reversal of the district court. Of the district court's reasoning. I mean,
did an attorney-client privilege attach to the documents because they were given by the client to the attorney? And here's the problem that you have. I mean, I'll just cut it all away because the issue is attorney-client privilege, not Fifth Amendment. But if the client gave the documents to the attorney for the purpose of the attorney turning them over to the government, then there's no possible attorney-client privilege because they were not intended to be kept confidential.
I understand exactly what Your Honor is saying. There is, as Your Honor, I know, is already aware, there is a factual issue in terms of whether or not the former attorney, in fact, handed over the originals to the government, or rather, handed over copies to the government.
Of the existence of the documents at that point, and there, at least something about the contents has been disclosed.
No question about that, Your Honor. Something about the contents. In fact, I mean, I don't think there's any dispute about the fact that the copies that are appended to the subpoena were disclosed by the former attorney.
It's no different than it's the following situation, where the client gives the attorney a note and says, in a bank robbery case, and it says, "I did it," right? Give this to the prosecution, and they turn it over to the prosecution. Now, if the purpose of that, of the note, was to get legal advice, that's one thing. But if the purpose of giving the note to the attorney is to turn it over to the prosecution, there's no attorney-client privilege.
Well, I certainly understand Your Honor's point. And as I indicated, we didn't focus on that issue because the district court essentially, I guess you could say, went our way on it. I mean, the district court assumed without deciding that the documents had to have been furnished for purposes of legal advice. And it's my submission to Your Honor that, you know, based on the overall record of this case, it's clear that that had to have been the purpose of turning over the documents. In terms of when the decision—
It's also clear, and I think it's well established in, even today, that the documents were turned over to the government by the former attorney.
The copies were turned over.
All right. Some form of the documents was turned over.
Yes, indeed, Your Honor. That is established. I don't think there's any—
That's not consistent with the notion that they were given just for the purpose of rendering legal advice.
Well, Again, I don't know that it seems to me there are some blanks there that haven't been filled in. I mean, it's quite possible, in fact, happens all the time in my practice, that there can be a private communication between an attorney and a client, which is intended at the time the communication occurs to be private, and then at some subsequent time it's determined to be in the client's tactical interest that some limited disclosure be made, and so it's quite possible that the decision to make a disclosure was made some considerable time after.
Would that matter if the documents at the time that they're turned over to the government have lost the character of being documents that were handed over to obtain legal advice? Why would it matter if the first, in fact, it might even be the norm that the first view the attorney has of it is to render legal advice? That doesn't mean that he doesn't have them at the time of turning over for the purpose of turning over.
I'm not sure it would matter. I tend to agree with Your Honor with respect to that point. And I guess where my issue is here with respect to the question posed by Judge Randolph, I mean, and again, I'm sorry I don't have the precise series of paragraphs in the Fisher case in my mind, perhaps as literally as I should, but I know that the analysis below was to the effect that it was a sort of a preliminary issue that the district court addressed in terms of whether or not, and indeed it was an attorney-client privilege issue in terms of whether or not the documents had been turned over for purposes of seeking legal advice. And I believe, just briefly in a footnote, the district court assumes without deciding that that is the case, and then the district court turns to what it deemed and what I certainly thought was the fundamental issue, which was then implicated, which is the issue of Fifth Amendment, not attorney-client.
Well, I understand you to be arguing both Fifth Amendment and attorney-client. You have three issues set forth.
That's correct. And
which was Fifth Amendment related, the second and third, I suppose, were attorney-client.
That's correct, Your Honor.
The language you're looking for is, if you've got the sealed appendix, is at 103. Which is where the district judge quotes Fisher with that caveat that where the client transfers the document to the attorney for purposes of obtaining legal advice, footnote, I'm assuming that without finding that, and then the quote, I think is what you're relying on, when the client himself would be privileged, either as a party of common law or exempt. The attorney having possession of the document is not bound to produce.
That's precisely right, Judge Henderson. That's exactly the language. And it does seem to me that that language, I mean, certainly there, I absolutely concede, Judge Randolph. I mean, there is an kind of a preliminary or a threshold issue here of attorney-client privilege. But it seems to me, at least if I'm reading that correctly, that once that hurdle is overcome, and again, certainly it may be that it hasn't been, but we submit that it has, then it becomes an issue of active production, Fifth Amendment privilege, I think. And that's my submission.
The reasoning that, well, first of all, Fisher ends by saying it's going to depend on, it always does, on the facts and circumstances of each particular case, and we have an unusual thing here. But and second of all, in the grand jury Monica Lewinsky case, which you've read, you know, we followed Fisher in exactly the manner that I'm suggesting to you now. What the Supreme Court has said is that if somebody's giving documents to the attorney for legal advice, right, that we're not going to allow the government to get the documents from the attorney when the government couldn't have gotten them from the client, and because that's part of the attorney-client privilege. And the question is whether the government could have gotten them from the client. But there's a temporal aspect to that, and the question is not when the doctor had the documents and hadn't turned them over to the attorney yet. It's after, you know, at the point when the subpoena comes down. By that time, the client had already had the documents turned over to the government, so there would have been no bar to the government getting them from the client. So.
With respect to I absolutely concede that that's an issue which I didn't focus very hard on because it was an issue that was really treated essentially as a threshold issue below, and that's what I thought it was.
Right.
But I mean, I can't disagree with the proposition that if that's the relevant moment, and if in fact it's intended that the documents be disclosed to the government, that there is an issue certainly with respect to whether or not the attorney-client privilege continues to apply there. From my point of view, though, if the Fifth Amendment privilege is in fact implicated here, which I thought it was and submit that it is, then And I'll just say this very quickly, because I can see I'm running out of time, but there is a fundamental, from my point of view, a fundamental defect, a fundamental illogic in the notion that so long as the government knows with particularity what the documents are, that that's the end of the inquiry, and that the privilege, the Fifth Amendment privilege, is thereby eviscerated. It's and there certainly is. I mean, I have to concede there are cases. The 1993 case from the Second Circuit suggests that, and there are other cases that suggest it as well, but it's my submission that it is fundamentally illogical, because of the authentication component that's set forth in Hubbell and a variety of other cases.
From an agent rather than from the client, can that authentication component really be considered to breach the Fifth Amendment to the client? Or this has been handed to the attorney's turning over what's been handed to him, he already had it before the subpoena was issued. If there had been a search warrant for his office and the law had come in and got it, would it really be any different than it is?
Well, I guess, you know, at least in terms of the way I've thought about this case, I mean, if the set of facts here with respect to the attorney-client privilege is such that the district court's threshold conclusion that the privilege didn't apply, thereby triggering the Fifth Amendment privilege, is wrong, and if the court is prepared to say, based on this record, that it is clearly wrong, then I guess I would have to concede Your Honor's point. But if, in fact, the Fifth Amendment privilege does apply here, and if it can be asserted by the attorney just as if it were being asserted by the client, then given the authentication component here, given the
authentication component, is all that you have.
That's
turning over a physical evidence is not in and of itself a breach of the Fifth Amendment. That goes without saying. It has to be testimonial. And all you've got here that's testimonial is the authentication component.
Well, there is a point that is set forth in our reply brief, in which we seek to invoke the concurring language from Justice Thomas in the Hubbell case. That language suggests that that proposition that Your Honor just uttered, which is, I absolutely concede, a matter of settled law in every circuit that I'm aware of, may not be right, and that the Supreme Court...
If we were able to do as Justice Thomas proposes and go back and re-examine constitutional questions ab initio, there might be some argument about that. But we can't, and the rest of the Supreme Court thus far hasn't decided to, so you're stuck with that. The only thing you've got is that.
I really can't disagree with what Your Honor just said. I think that the fundamental issue here for us is the component of authentication. And given that the position that the doctor, through his attorney, is being put in here is, authentication, and this is a sort of an elusive concept, frankly, and one that a lot of the cases dealing with active production privilege really don't focus very hard on. But it is specifically stated in the Hubbell case that authenticity refers to whether a document is genuine as opposed to a forgery or a fabrication. And so the situation that's created here, just assuming for the sake of argument for a moment that the Fifth Amendment privilege is applicable here, despite the disclosure of documents by the attorney. Responding to this subpoena by the attorney, it contains the implicit, assuming that, you know, the originals of the copies that are appended to the subpoena are produced by the attorney, that is an implicit testimonial assertion by the attorney and the client to the effect that these documents are genuine as opposed to being a forgery or a fabrication, and requiring that kind of testimonial assertion.
I think a subpoena would call for them whether they have falsifications in them or not. I mean, it provides the copies with the subpoenas to give us these documents.
Well,
it's saying these are those documents.
Well, I think that's an interesting point, Your Honor. And if the subpoena, in fact, had said, if there had been a forthwith subpoena that had said, produce the originals of the attached copies, I'm not even sure that would have. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I realize there's some language above that may be read more broadly, but
this is on page 14 of the joint appendix.
Didn't Judge Hogan read the subpoena in the way that Judge Santel just described it?
Yes.
And so now you have a judicial construction of the subpoena that, if upheld, would alleviate the problem that you're addressing.
Yeah.
Well, it certainly would alleviate part of it in terms of, you know, the first prong of my argument,
right,
that the subpoena could be interpreted.
I and got way off my point, but if you turned over those documents, you complied with the subpoena.
As construed by Judge Hogan.
Not construed.
Well, I'm not sure how explicit Judge Hogan was on that point. Certainly, it's clear to me that Judge Hogan focused only on the originals of those.
A contempt hearing for not turning over something other than what's in those copies. You'd have another issue for another day.
Well, absolutely. And in fact, I don't mean to.
We've talked you way past your time, and that's not your fault nearly as much as it's ours. But it's our habit. We're not like the Supreme Court. We overrule the clock most of the time. Unless you have a question.
I've got one question, and that is, when you were responding to Judge Randolph's question about if the client gives the document to the attorney for the purpose of legal advice, and the attorney later produces it to the government, that then loses the privilege. That's your position, but how about, is there a gap there if, and I don't think you're making that argument here, a gap there if the attorney produces it to the government without the client's either knowledge or permission? I mean, I don't think you're not making that argument here.
I'm not suggesting for 1 minute that the prior attorney in fact did that here. So in that sense, I'm not making the argument. I guess what I would say, though, is that I think there are a lot of blanks to be filled in terms of, you know, just sort of what happened, what was authorized and what wasn't authorized, and what the attorney.
No, it was your burden.
It's our burden to establish the act of production privilege generally. I think that's right. I mean, we thought we had carried that burden with respect to the proffer that we made, and there was no hearing below at which there was an opportunity to submit any additional facts.
Thank you, counsel. We'll
thank you so much.
Use your time up. We'll give you back a couple minutes for the bundle if needed.
Appreciate it very much, Your Honor.
We'll hear from the government.
Good morning, may I please report Patricia Heffernan along with Elizabeth Trostman and Virginia Cheatham on behalf of the United States. There was no dispute in the district court about what documents the grand jury sought. As the court has pointed out, Chief Judge Hogan understood the subpoena to be requesting the limited set of documents attached to the subpoena, and in fact, appellant understood that as well. And his response at in the appendix at page 79, the response describes the subpoena seeking the originals of the documents which the government has copies of. The government was plainly seeking the source documents for these copies, and everybody in the district court understood that. And that was the underlying premise of Chief Judge Hogan's ruling below, certainly implicit in the authentication, for example, the authentication ruling that the government already has copies of these documents in its possession. So this broad reading and suggestion that the subpoena is ambiguous is presented here for the first time, but not one that was the premise for the district court's ruling below. And the court would need to accept that premise in order to accept appellant's other various arguments about how production of the documents would be so testimonial, such that the Fifth Amendment would be implicated. And as we've pointed out in our brief, all of these factors, obviously the existence and possession were not disputed, and the government could authenticate these documents without relying on the truth-telling of the client or the lawyer, which is the foregone conclusion test. The government has the copies, and it would present the source documents to the jury, coupled with the representation from the lawyer, the fact that the lawyer had provided the copies to the government. And that would be enough to show that the documents are what the government, as the proponent, says they are, which is the source documents, the documents from which the copies in the government's possession were generated. I would happy to answer any questions that the court has. I know the court had.
Seeing none.
I did want to point out, just with respect to one thing that Judge Randolph was discussing, the court did discuss this sort of conduit theory, the notion that the documents were never privileged from the inception because they were delivered to the lawyer to be delivered to the government. In In Re Sealed Case at 877 Fed 3rd, I think at 979, is the discussion where the court discusses Fourth Circuit cases, talking about how these documents would never have been privileged from the
which In Re?
In Re Sealed Case at 877 Fed 2nd.
Oh, you said Fed 3rd.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Yeah, no, no. Yeah. Fed 2nd. And 879, I think, is the let me see, 976 and 979 is the particular discussion.
Thanks. We've reached the point where attorneys consider F-second cases to be old cases.
That's right.
Notwithstanding the fact that the members of this panel wrote a number of F-second. Well, thank you, counsel.
Thank you. We'd ask that the order be affirmed.
1 minute.
Thank you.
1 minute would be fine. Okay, give him 1 minute, please.
Thank you so much. I just wanted to clarify, if it wasn't clear before, that the two prongs of the argument that I'm seeking to make here are not, in fact, interdependent. In other words, the court does not have to accept the notion that the subpoena is ambiguous or that it's broader than the attached copies to consider or accept the proposition that the authentication component itself requires reversal below. That's all I had to say.
Thank you
so much.